Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Bus and Rail Subcommittee meeting today on Monday, November 8th, 2021. To begin with, please note that this meeting is being recorded and the meeting audio will be placed on our website, which is wmata.com. Just to share some helpful tips for anyone joining via phone call to speak, you can unmute yourself and you can press star six. That will unmute and mute your voice, your speaker. And if you'd like to make some virtual, your comments, you can raise your virtual hands and lower your virtual hands by pressing star nine. Everyone joining via the video conference, you can click on the speaker icon that will unmute or mute you, your speaker. And to raise your virtual hands, you can go under reactions and click on the hand raise icon that lowers and raises your hand. At this point, everyone should be on mute. We do request one speaker at a time because it helps eliminate any external noise and clarity of the speaker. As you know, we do have interpreters on this call with us. Therefore, I would request everyone stating their name or making their comments. It helps them doing their job well, and it also helps everyone on the listening on the phone calls knowing who is the speaker. If we do have any members of the public who would like to make any public comments, please inform me in advance if you can. You can send me a chat message and let me know so that I can put you on the list. We do have some presenters with us, and I would request that if you have any visual presentation, a slide deck, PowerPoint, anything, please describe your presentation in detail for the convenience of our members and members of the public who are blind or have low vision. At this point, Chair Calabia, I would ask, with your permission, I can go ahead and read the meeting agenda for today.
Please.
Okay, thank you. I would also share my screen for the convenience of everyone who can see, for them to be able to read the agenda as well. So give me a moment.
Hi, this is Tiffany Ramsey. I'm one of the interpreters. I'm wondering if you could please spotlight the interpreters' videos while we're working. That would make it easier for people who are trying to access the sign interpretation to see it.
I can actually make you co-host and
we can do that ourselves then.
Yes. Yes.
Well, okay. And then Ms. Sakachala will take care of it. Thank you very much.
Sure. And Rico Dancy is the member of AAC member who requires the service. So give me a couple of minutes. As soon as I'm done with the agenda and attendance, I'll make you co-hosts.
Thank you very much.
Joe, you're welcome. All right, going over the meeting agenda, I'm hoping that my screen is visible at this point.
It is.
Thank you. So after reading the agenda, I would go through the roll call of the committee members. Afterwards, Chair Calabia will go through the motions of reviewing and approval of today's meeting agenda and last month's meeting minutes. Afterwards, we have Montgomery County representative to discuss floating bus stops within Montgomery County. At 4:45, we will have Hannah Rowe. She would speak about platform rehabilitation 3 completed and platform rehabilitation 4. We do have Jim Hamry, who's going to discuss bus services changes effective December. And he would also talk about Metrobus e-paper signage installation locations. After that, we would have any public comments. And the meeting would adjourn at 6 p.m. At this point, I would stop sharing my screen. Okay, now I would go ahead and take the roll call of the committee members. So please confirm your attendance. Elver Ariza Silva. Dani Sposh. Gino Calabia.
Present.
Thank you. Vanessa Coles. Vico Dancy. Deborah Fisher. Marcy Goldstein. Melanie Henderson. Melanie is on the call with us. She might be having some trouble, audio trouble. Steve Caffin.
Present.
Thank you.
I'm present.
Okay, thank you. Philippa Mazel.
Present.
Thank you. Anthony Oberg is unable to join us today. He informed me earlier. Phil Posner.
Present.
Thank you. Doris Ray. Denise Rush.
Present.
Thank you. Paul Summerford. Patrick Sheehan. And Kelly Simonon.
I'm here.
Okay, thank you. That concludes our roster for today's bus and rail subcommittee meeting. Chair Calabia, at this point, I would ask for you to move the meeting forward. You have the floor.
Yes, we hastily went over the draft minutes of our October meeting, and now we're reviewing it in order to approve the minutes. And let's see, in October we talked about floating bus stops with Paul Munier and a few others of his team representing Arlington County. apparently there was at the time only one floating bus stop. We did see a photo partially showing that bus stop, and we asked for a better view or views of that bus stop. Do you know if that was received, Anu, if the photos of the one bus stop in Arlington County were any received?
Chair Calabi, I had not received any photographs as of yet.
Okay, I guess we'll have to go back to him on that. We also talked about, let's see. well, one of the points that Carol Lopez raised was, how would a person know they have to cross a bike path to get to a floating bus stop? And she also asked, how would they know what appears on the floating island itself, such as maybe newspaper boxes or any kind of seating? And Mr. Munier said that they would review that question. Megan Kanagi of the District of Columbia team that has designed and set up floating bus stops came and said that they were looking forward to hearing what further information we obtained from other jurisdictions about their floating bus stops and anything else that we ourselves discover. And we also heard from Matt Johnson of Montgomery County. Is Matt Johnson the speaker for Montgomery County today?
Yes, he is.
Okay. And then we heard from Jim Hammer about the bus planning at that time. let's see. We also heard from Jim about pedestrian signal messages. And we then opened for public comments, but there were none. So having gone over the draft minutes a second time, do I hear a motion to approve the minutes that we had of the October meeting?
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve the minutes and also add one item that Dr. Loh, L-O-H, has been added as the DC representative to the board of directors, and she is active in the bicycle community and someone we should invite to come talk to us about the role of bicycles in the floating bus stops.
Excellent, excellent, that'd be great. Perhaps we could hear from her at the December meeting if she's available. with respect to the minutes, do I have a second to Phil's motion for approval?
I'll second on that. Tina, this is Pat.
Thank you, Patrick. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, and thank you for all the work you're doing on the floating bus stops, Tino. Nice work on that.
Good. Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. You did some early spade work, especially since our former colleague, Charlie Crawford, brought it to our attention. And you, Charlie, and I are all three from Montgomery County. Charlie has passed on, but we're trying to keep the interest of floating bus stops in focus with the bus rail subcommittee and with the full committee. Having had a motion and a second, do I hear any voice of approval for the minutes?
Well, Tino, this is Ms. Rush. How many AAC members are in attendance today? Is it only five?
No, Ms. Rush, I can give you the count in just a quick second.
Denise, this is Pat. I came in a little bit late.
We have 10 at this point.
We have 10 in attendance today?
Yes.
Oh, we didn't hear them say anything.
Some people may have been slightly delayed, and that's the reason they may not have had responses at the time I called the roll call.
Okay, thank you.
Anu, for Denise and the rest of us, could you mention who now are involved in the meeting?
Can we call the motion, and without objection to the motion on the floor, it has passed.
Okay, the motion has passed to approve the minutes, but again, Anu, so all of us know who of the AAC membership is here. Could you name them, please?
Sure. So I would I'll read the names. I see Dr. Posner, I see Chair Calabia, Kelly, Ms. Rush, Thomas Mangrum, Rico Dancy, Philippa Mazel, Melanie Henderson, Deborah Fisher, Vanessa Coles. Actually, we have more than 10. Patrick Sheehan, and Steve Kaplan.
Oh, good. Yes, thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Anu.
Sure.
So now we have on the agenda, we're going to hear from Montgomery County, and I gather I saw that Matt Johnson is in the meeting. Can I assume, Matt, that you are representing Montgomery County to discuss the floating bus stops there?
Yes, Chair Calabria, that's correct.
Great. So welcome, Matt. You've been with us previously, and we know that you have a number of floating bus stops in the county, in contrast to Arlington, which only had one. So it's yours now to present what you're doing there in Montgomery County.
Sure thing. And you could help me enable screen sharing, I have a presentation I can share. So we'll stand by for just a minute, but while we're waiting, I'll go ahead and introduce myself. My name is Matt Johnson, and I am a capital project manager with the Montgomery County Department of Transportation. So let me just share my screen here. So you should be able to see the presentation shortly.
Yes, it's visible.
Great. So I'm here to talk to you today about floating bus stops in Montgomery County, and specifically some of the improvements that we're working on to make them more accessible for people who have visual impairments. A little background: in Montgomery County, we built our first floating bus stops in 2017. There were four of them built that year as part of a bike project on Spring Street and Cedar Street in downtown Silver Spring. And you can see pictures of those on the screen here, and I'll just describe those. But these are pictures of two of the floating bus stops. The top picture shows the railway to the left. You then have a concrete bus platform followed by a bikeway that's channelized, meaning the bike lane's the same elevation as the street, and then the sidewalk. The bus platform and the sidewalk are at the same elevation, and the street and the bike lane are at the same elevation. And so that means that when you want to go from the sidewalk to the bus stop, you go down a ramp like you would encounter at an intersection, you cross over the bike lane in a marked crosswalk, and then you go up a ramp onto the bus platform. And there is a sign for the bus stop on the bus platform. This particular bus stop does not have a shelter or a bench, because these four bus stops were very low volume bus stops, and did not feel that there was a need for bus shelters or benches, but they certainly can be installed at other bus platforms. What we learned from, and the bottom picture just shows a kind of a close-up of that ramp detail, so you can kind of see that when you cross over, there's a header curb that you can detect with a cane. A header curb is just a raised curb that you can detect with your cane if you're using a white cane, so that you don't inadvertently walk beyond the bus platform and into the roadway. What we found from these first four floating bus stops was that the 8-foot minimum, which is required under the Americans with Disabilities Act, I apologize, I have a cat working on my desk here. Let me just move that.
Matt, this is Anu. Sorry for interrupting, but your voice is not coming very clearly.
Sorry, I'll try and speak up a little bit.
Thank you.
I have to look directly at the camera, and I think the issue was my cat walked in front of the monitor and interrupted my voice. So I was just moving my cat off the desk. What we learned from this is that the 8-foot minimum width that's required under the ADA is not really wide enough, because the ramp that's deployed when the bus is at the bus stop can sometimes deploy. It depends on how close the bus is to the curb. But if the bus is too close to the curb, the space between the end of the ramp and the back of the platform can be insufficient for someone in a wheelchair to maneuver. So as a result, we've modified our design standards, and we shoot for a 10-foot minimum width, although in certain situations we might be able to go down to 9 feet if it's really tight, but we prefer to do at least 10 feet. We also learned that having the channelized bike lane, meaning having the bike lane at street elevation, really can be more problematic, especially for people who have wheelchairs. And so as a result, we are not using we're not going to use the channelized approach anymore, or if we do, it'll be a sort of a hybrid option where at least at the crossing location, the bike lane will be raised up to sidewalk elevation so that you don't have to go down and make turns on the bus platform in a wheelchair. So all four of these are going to be rebuilt to our new standards in 2022 so that they will be easier for people who have disabilities to navigate to. And then
Matt, excuse me, before you move away from those two first pictures, can I point out something? If you could move back to the first two, please.
Yeah, yes.
The bottom picture shows that there is an abutment. For example, if a person does not want to stop and take a bus on that platform, but they want to continue to cross, some people with low vision may not notice that there is that sloping barrier there. Will that be taken care of? Because I think that is a risky feature that's built into the platform as it now exists.
Well, this is not a crossing location. I mean, I think what this is analogous to saying is someone who's on the Glenmont platform at Metro Center who wants to go to the Shady Grove platform and saying, well, the Metro tracks are a problem. Well, this is not where you cross the street. If you want to cross the street, there's a marked, signalized crosswalk about 20 yards to your left. So in this image, this is not where you cross the street. I understand the point that you're making, but we have to have a way so that a blind person knows that they're not supposed to continue across the street here. We don't want them to be, if there was no curb there, you could wander right across there and never realize you were entering the roadway. And there's not a marked crossing here. So this is specifically designed to prevent people from inadvertently walking into the street in this location. It's not a place where you're supposed to cross the street. But that being said, we are moving away from channelized bike lanes, as I mentioned before, which means that you won't be at street level. You'll be up 6 inches. So if you were in the future case, you would be crossing at the same elevation. There wouldn't be a ramp. You would be at the same elevation as the sidewalk. And when you get to the far side, there would be a vertical curb, a vertical 6-inch drop to the roadway, which is just like you find at the edge of any sidewalk, any curb in the area. But now I understand the point that you're making, but this is not a crossing location. So we do not want people to cross the street here. So in 2017, after we installed the first four floating bus stops, we did take a focus group of blind and low vision users out to these bus stops to get feedback on how they were able to use them and if there were things that we could do to make improvements. And we got some good feedback from that group. And we incorporated that feedback into our next set of floating bus stops, which were built in 2019. So the images that you see here, the top image is the same as the top image you saw on the previous slide. The bottom image is for comparison's sake, and this shows one of our next three floating bus stops that were built in 2019. This one is located at 2nd Avenue and Colesville Road. So this was a set of three floating bus stops that were built in 2019. And this was kind of when we started to really get significant pushback about our floating bus stops. Even though we had them in 2017, we hadn't gotten a lot of pushback until these were constructed. And that was when Charlie Crawford, I think, first brought these to your attention. And we had some conversations with Charlie and Susan Crawford and other people in the community and made some improvements to these even before the project was completed based on that feedback. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I should describe this, the bottom image, for people who can't see it. But this is a very similar perspective. You can see the roadway is to the left. There's been a raised bus platform that's the same elevation as the sidewalk. And then you have a bike lane, which is painted green, which is also at the same elevation. And then you have a concrete sidewalk, which is all at the same elevation. So the bike lane, the bus platform, and the sidewalk are all at the same elevation, which means you don't have to go down to cross the bike lane and then go back up. There is a shelter on this platform because it's a busier stop. There is a bench. There's also trash cans at both ends. There is a transverse railing along the front and back of the platform, where the front of the bus and the back of the bus would be, and also a railing along with the back of the bus shelter along the bike lane edge of the platform to kind of hem in people so they don't go beyond the areas where they're supposed to be or get lost on the platform.
Is the bike lane a one-way bike lane? Because there are bike lanes that are two ways, bikes going in both directions.
This bike lane is a two-way bike lane. The image that was the first set of floating bus stops I talked about are one-way bike lanes, but this is right. A two-way bike lane on this side.
And this is the two-way.
Yes. So what we've heard from the disability community is that, especially with the channelized floating bus stops, that wheelchair users have challenges, that blind and low vision users have difficulty locating the floating bus stops, which you mentioned in your introduction as well, and that blind and low vision users cannot see or hear oncoming cyclists. So these are the sort of main areas of concern that we've heard, and we're working to address those issues. So I want to talk a little bit about what the kind of access and safety features we've already incorporated into our designs, and what, and also later I'm going to talk about what we're going to do in the future. So in this image, you can see we're standing on the sidewalk looking toward a bus that is stopped at that bus platform. And you can see there are people who are boarding the bus from the bus island here. The area circled here is a one single pad of detectable warning surface, or the truncated domes. This was added based on that feedback we got in 2017. One of the things that the blind and low vision users said that they wanted was they wanted some confirmation that they knew they were standing where the front door of the bus would be. They were afraid, you know, if they were out on this bus island, but they weren't kind of toward where the front of the bus was going to be, that the bus might not stop and it might pass them by, thinking that they would maybe weren't there to catch the bus. So they just wanted some reassurance that they were standing in the right place. So we did add that. This area here that's highlighted shows where the bus ramp would deploy if a wheelchair user was using the bus. And what you can see from this is that you can roll off the bus and go straight down the ramp and go straight across the bike line. You don't have to make any maneuvers on the bus platform itself. You can go straight from the bus to the sidewalk. You don't have to worry about making a 90 degree turn where maybe there's not enough space. And that's one of the reasons that we have everything level at this location. We also have railings. I mentioned we have a transverse railing, which is on the right there, which prevents people from going beyond the crosswalk. There's no need to be out on the nose of the island there. And there's also a longitudinal railing that runs along the bike lane edge of the bus platform that prevents people from crossing outside the crosswalks. And if you're a blind or a low vision user, you can use this railing to find the openings where the crosswalks are located. Now, some of our bus platforms only have one crosswalk. This one in particular has two. You can only see the one at the forward end of the bus platform, but there is one at the rear as well. And this image shows a wheelchair user boarding the bus. The ramp is deployed, so you can kind of see how that ramp lines up with the crosswalk. Now, I will point out that the crosswalk markings, you may note, are missing at the bottom of the image, and that's because the water company came out and did some work there, but that crosswalk has been replaced. Just at the time I was taking this picture, there was an asphalt patch there temporarily. We also have some navigation treatments. So this is another view of that same bus island. In this case, we're looking in the opposite direction. So the sidewalk is to the left. We then have the two-way bike lane, the bus platform with the shelter and railings, and then the street is to the right. There is lighting both behind the sidewalk and built into the bus shelter. So there is lighting on this bus island. And that is something that we are focused on, ensuring that there's adequate lighting in these areas so that cyclists and pedestrians can see each other, and so that the bus drivers and other drivers can also see people waiting on the bus platform. There is a high visibility marked crosswalk at both ends. In this case, there's an entrance at both ends. Some of them only have entrances at one end, but this one has entrances at both ends. We have detectable warning surfaces on both sides of each crosswalk, so that if you're blind or low vision, you know that you're about to cross over something, and you have you're aware that there may be conflicting traffic. Outside of the crosswalks, there is a 2-inch high curb reveal. This is to help blind people find the edge of the sidewalk with a cane. This is something that we're working on, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in our next stage of design, but trying to make that a little bit more detectable for people. We also added these longitudinal detectors, and I have another image that shows these in just a minute, but these are, instead of the bumpy domes, these are sort of ridges and valleys that are detectable to people underfoot or with a cane. And this is just meant to help people find the entrance. We also added this white flex post here on the top of the curb, which we're calling, it's a temporary measure. We call it an orientation flex post, but Susan Crawford, who you may know from this committee, she uses this bus stop regularly, and she asked us just to have something to help her reassure herself that she was in the right location. We're currently working on the design for a sign that could be a standard sign that can be used in this area to indicate that you're going to cross a floating bus stop. We would install all of our floating bus stops, and that we would encourage the other jurisdictions in the region to use. So that's something we're working on this fiscal year. and hopefully we'll have a prototype in 2022 that we can test out with blind and low vision users, and that would replace this flex post. And this is just another image that shows the longitudinal strip here on the sidewalk. These are very common outside of the United States. They're very common in Asia. They're fairly common in Europe, and they are getting more use in other places like Canada and other places in the world. But we don't use them very much in the United States. WMATA does have one located on the Shady Grove platform at Gallery Place Station to indicate where the back of a six-car train stops. DDOT has a couple of these that are installed along K Street where the buses stop on, the buses use the main line and stop on the islands. And they help blind people get from the bus stops on those islands to the line up in the crosswalk to cross over the service lanes to get to the sidewalk on K Street. We also have some what we call calming treatments. These markings are called shark's teeth, and they're a yield marking. Indicate that cyclists are required to yield to pedestrians. We've also painted the bike lane green in this location to indicate that it's a conflict zone, both to cyclists and pedestrians. The green paint doesn't necessarily help people who have low vision, but cyclists can see it, as can the other pedestrians who cross over here. We've also added centerline flex posts along the center of the two-way bike lane to make the bike lane feel narrower. This is proven making the bike lane feel narrower psychologically. It encourages people to slow down. So this is a treatment to help slow down cyclists in this area. And we've also added these signs that say state law, stop for pedestrians within crosswalk, to make it absolutely clear that if you're a cyclist, you are required to stop for pedestrians who are in the crosswalk. Some additional calming treatments. Now this image is, we've moved back a little bit so you can kind of see more of the bus stop. It's the same bus stop, we've just stepped a little bit further back. And what you can see here is that there is what's called a lateral shift here, meaning the bike lane sort of swerves over a little bit. And this encourages cyclists to slow down because they have to turn and slow down for this turn. There's also vertical deflection, essentially a speed hump. Cyclists have to go up as they approach the bus platform. The word slow is painted on the street to make it clear that cyclists need to slow down here. And since this picture was taken, we've added rumble strips in this area that's shown with these red markings. And these are just a bump sensation as cyclists go over, they'll feel these bumps. To help call attention to the fact that there's a conflict coming up. So these are all things that we've already done on some of our floating bus stops. And as I said, we're working on upgrading some of the older floating bus stops as well. So one of the things that I think I might have mentioned at your last meeting, but one of the things that we worked on over the past year was we got a grant from the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments to study how we could improve our public spaces for people who have vision disabilities. So this is not just floating bus stops, it's also crosswalks and sidewalks and other places in the public realm. The document that was created is called Planning and Designing Streets to be Safer and More Accessible for People Who Have Vision Disabilities. And I would encourage you, if you haven't had a chance to take a look at this report, to take a look at it. It's on our website. It is screen reader compatible. Anu can send out a link to everyone. I'll make sure that Anu has that link. You don't have to speedily copy it down right now. We'll make sure we get that link up to you. But that included that toolkit, and it also included a pilot design for one intersection in Silver Spring, which will have a floating bus stop. So this is helping us work toward our next generation of floating bus stops that incorporate all that we've learned over the past couple of years. These are just some screenshots from that report that just show the text and some images from that report. So it's just kind of filler, but I would encourage you to take a look at the report and learn more about what we're working on and what we hope could lead to some federal guidance nationally. Right now, there's no federal guidance on a lot of these topics. What I think is really critical in this process is making sure that we engage people who have vision disabilities. We don't need to be planning for them, we need to be planning with them. And that's a very important distinction. One of the things that the report notes is that it requires a different kind of engagement. We need to make sure that we're very proactive, because people who have vision disabilities are often not aware of projects that might affect them until after they have gone to construction, because maybe they couldn't read the letter that came. So making sure that we reach out to the different groups who represent people with vision disabilities, organizations like this one. In Montgomery County, we have a commission on people with disabilities, making sure we have a mailing list and helping get people who who want more information about specifically about transit access for people with vision disabilities, making sure we have access to email lists and things like that so that we can get the word out and get them involved in an early stage. One of the things that we're doing right now is we're piloting the use of tactile graphics. And I think I have a picture of some of those later on in the presentation. But these are graphics that you can feel with your fingers. You don't have to, you know, have someone explain a plan to you. You can actually touch the plan and feel where the different features are. And so we're testing out the use of that right now with one project. And we hope that especially for projects that are likely to have an extra big impact on people who have vision disabilities, that these kind of graphics will become more commonplace. And here are some images that show those tactile graphics being tested out. And in fact, Pat Sheehan, who is on this call, is in the picture here with one of these, as is Susan Crawford. So we developed these, and what you can see, the left graphic is a kind of close up. The right graphic shows some low vision people using the graphics. And these graphics have different elevations. So the road is actually lower than the sidewalk, so you can feel the curb. It's not a real size, one-to-one scale, but there's actually an elevation difference between the sidewalk and the road. The sidewalk texture is different than the road texture, so you can feel the difference when you're feeling with your fingers. There's also a raised kind of dashed marking for the bike lane, so you can kind of feel where the bike lane is. You can actually feel the bumps for the tactile warning surfaces. You can feel where the accessible pedestrian signal is located. So these are all, you can feel the markings for the crosswalks. So these are all things that are designed in so that people who have vision disabilities are able to engage in the process and give us feedback in real time. Also, the report notes that it's important to have outreach after the project is constructed to make sure that once it's been built, that it's operating as intended and there aren't any unintended side effects. So you can see in this image, we're actually standing on that same bus platform that I was using a couple slides ago. It's not complete. You can't really tell from this picture, but it's actually not finished yet. But you can see Charlie and Susan Crawford are standing here talking to some people from MCDOT. I actually took the picture, so I'm not in the picture, but I was here for this meeting as well. And just talking about how we could make this bus stop work better for them. So this is, and we actually made some of the recommendations that they made for us. We actually made those changes shortly after the project was completed. We made some modifications. So having these kind of meetings really is important to helping to understand kind of how we can do better and learning from any mistakes that have been made so that we don't make them again. Another thing that the report recommends is that we build a testing and training facility or build mock-ups for projects. And you can see a picture here from Portland, Oregon. This is, they've built a floating bus stop. This is actually what we call a shared platform bus stop, but it's similar to a floating bus stop. It's built out of plywood. There's the transit agency has brought a bus, so the bus is actually there. There's also a bike that's parked on the edge of the screen, but everything is built out of plywood and other temporary materials. So instead of waiting until the project's actually, you know, gone to construction and had concrete out there and moved utilities and moved drainage, we build it with plywood in a parking lot somewhere so we can test it out and see if it works, see what works, what doesn't work, what needs to be changed. And we can bring the transit agency out, bring the bus drivers out, we can bring low vision people out, we can bring bicyclists out, we can kind of see how the different pieces work and what needs to be changed. So we are planning to build a mock-up of our, I mentioned those original four floating bus stops, we're going to upgrade those. We're going to build mock-ups of those first, hopefully sometime in early 2022, and bring people who have expressed interest, both people in wheelchairs, people who have vision disabilities, we're going to bring them out and test out the mock-ups, and we may make up a couple different versions, and we may make two or three versions and see which ones work best, and then we can bring those out in the real world. In terms of designing streets for people who have vision disabilities, the report does talk a lot about what kinds of disabilities people have and how they're different. Not everyone who's blind or low vision navigates the world the same way. So the report talks a little bit about how people who have who are completely blind, essentially, or almost completely blind, they rely a lot on their hearing. People who are low vision can still rely on what residual vision they have left. Some people are both deaf and blind and have to rely solely on tactile cues. And so the report talks a lot about this. I don't have time to go into all those details, but I would encourage you to read our report. I think it's a really amazing look at understanding how the design world can really change to benefit. In the picture here, you can see a blind person who is walking with a long white cane in downtown Silver Spring. The guide also talks a little bit about the different kinds of cues we can use, and we're running a little bit late, so I'm going to kind of skip through this slide really quickly. But basically, you know, there's different ways that we can indicate things to people who have low vision, including things like using surface changes, slope changes, and other kinds of treatments. I mentioned those longitudinal detectors, the guidance strips earlier, and there's a lot of information about guidance strips in the report. In the images here, you can see one that's being used in, I believe this is the UK, it's being used to indicate the location of a mid-block crosswalk so that blind or low vision people can locate this crosswalk that's not located at a signal. And the bottom three images, it's actually one image, they're just sort of three pictures superimposed together. They're all pictures of a pilot project that the Bay Area Rapid Transit District, or BART, is doing in, I believe this is in Contra Costa County in California. But they've used these guidance strips from a BART station and in all the surrounding areas, within a couple blocks of BART station. So you can, the tactile guidance strip will take you right through the fare gates, it will lead you to the bus loop, and will also lead you out into the sidewalk areas surrounding the station. So these are examples of how these can be used. Another tactile cue that we can use is an edge treatment. So the report talks a little bit about how do we define an edge. And in some cases, we need to have a flush edge. Like typically, if you're walking on the sidewalk, there might be a grass panel or a vertical curb between you and the street. But sometimes they need to be at the same elevation for a variety of reasons. And so how do we deal with creating an edge that's traversable by people, say, in bikes or by vehicles, but it keeps people who have low vision within the pedestrian space? So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail there. That's all in the report. We're really here to talk about floating bus stops, but I just wanted to talk a little bit about the report. So I'm going to skip over this. We've kind of already touched on most of these issues. One of the things that the report recommends is that the region begin moving toward using a unique and standard bus stop pole. So the image here is from the Salt Lake City region in Utah, where the Utah Transit Authority is working on testing out this sign. And the sign is a typical bus stop sign with some buses on it, but the pole is the real important thing here. The pole is bright blue, and it has an octagonal cross section, which means when you wrap your hand around the pole, it's not square and it's not a U-channel, it's octagonal. So it's the only thing that has this shape, this octagonal shape, is a bus stop sign. It's the only thing they'll use that pole for. And one of the things we heard from people during our outreach was, you know, sometimes we mount the bus stop sign to a lamppost. Sometimes we mount it to a regular square sign or a U-channel sign, and you can't distinguish those from, say, a stop sign or a no parking sign or a speed limit sign. You don't always know that you're at the bus stop. So this is one idea was, you know, if we use a standard pole, that bright blue would help people who have low vision or maybe cognitive impairments to see the only sign that looks like this is a bus stop sign. And then octagonal cross section could be used to for a person who's completely blind to kind of feel it and understand where they are. Now, it doesn't have to be just like this. This is what Utah is doing. Just an idea that we would like to see, potentially see rolled out throughout the region. And this will, of course, require coordination with WMATA and the other transit agencies in the region. And then finally, I just wanted to show our pilot design that came from the report. This is sort of our version 2.5 floating bus stop. It's still pretty similar to our the version 2.0 floating bus stops we built in 2019, but it does have some improvements. And I think this gets zoomed in here a little bit. I'm going to zoom in on the floating bus stop part here. What you can see is the bike lane is generally channelized, but it is raised at the crosswalk that's located at the front door of the bus. So we're looking at a plan view here. In this case, sidewalk is at the top of the image. There's a bike lane running left to right. Then there's a bus platform, and then the street is at the bottom of the image. You can only see half the street. You can't see the whole roadway. The bike lane is green. In this area, there are two marked crosswalks, high visibility marked crosswalks. One of them is raised, the one where the front door of the bus would stop. The crosswalk opposite that front door is raised, so the bikes would have to go over essentially a speed hump, but it's all level here. And the rear end of the bus is co-located with a signal. So one of the things that our director has promised is that going forward, our floating bus stops, whenever possible, will be co-located with signals. And what that means is that if you get off the bus and you want to cross whenever you want, you can go to the front door of the bus and cross there, and you have the right of way, but you don't have a walk sign or a red signal for bicyclists. But if you want that red signal, you can walk to the rear of the bus, go down the ramp, and you're now on the median refuge, and you can either turn left and cross over the bike lane to go to the nearest sidewalk, or you can turn right and cross over the roadway to go to the far side of the street, which will be co-located with a signal, which means you can push the button and wait, and eventually the bus, the bikes and the traffic will get a red signal and the walk sign will come on. There'll be an audible indication that you can cross the street, that it's safe to cross the street. These are things that we're moving toward. Now, in some cases, there may be bus stops that are not located at signalized intersections or places where they're too far from a signalized intersection where that won't work. But if we're close to a signal, we're going to locate our bus stops, our floating bus stops, at those signalized locations. And just really quickly, I know I'm a little bit past time here, but I want to talk about what we're doing to move this study and make these changes over the next year, the rest of this fiscal year. I know the slide here says in the next 10 months. This slide's a little bit old now, but basically these are the things that we're doing in the current fiscal year, which will end on June 30th of 2022. We are going to build those mock-ups, as I mentioned, so we can test out the new designs. We are going to upgrade the original four floating bus stops so that they meet the current standards. We're also going to begin the first round of training for all of our design staff. So anybody in DOT, including our transit facilities managers, our capital project managers, anyone who does our design, the people who review designs from development applications that come in, are going to start going through regular training on how to design for people who have vision disabilities, how to engage people with vision disabilities. We're also going to begin integrating these recommendations from the report into the projects that are currently in the design pipeline. As I mentioned, we're already piloting the design of use of tactile graphics with the project development process. We are going to host a regional summit to start working towards some commonalities in design for floating bus stops as best we can. There's probably always going to be some differences between the jurisdictions because they may hear different things from their residents and have different priorities. But we want to try and make these have commonalities across the region as best we can. And then finally, I mentioned this earlier, but we're going to create a standardized sign that will indicate that you're at a floating bus stop, you need to cross the bike lane, but it is distinguishable from the actual bus stop, because we don't want you to get here and think, oh, I'm already at the bus stop, but you're not there yet. So we want to have something that's distinguishable, easily detectable, and has all the information that's necessary. So that's one of the things that we're working on. We are going to build some mock-ups of that and then test it out before we roll anything out. So that's going to be probably tested along with those mock-ups that I mentioned. And then this is just a list that shows the current floating bus stops in Montgomery County and a couple that are in the construction pipeline. So right now we have 10 floating bus stops in Montgomery County. We have one shared platform stop, which is where you wait for the bus on the sidewalk, but you do have to cross the bike lane when the bus arrives. And then we have three more that are very close to construction. We have one that will be constructed around the end of this year. And we have two more that are expected to be constructed in 2022. So that would bring us up to 13 floating bus stops and one shared platform design. And you can see in the columns on the right, most of them are served by Ride-On. A couple of them are served by Metrobus. And we have one that's served by a pair of two. They're served by our Flash BRT line that operates in the Route 29 corridor. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. My contact information is on the screen now. My email address is matt.johnson, matt.johnson, johnson, at montgomerycountymd.gov. And Anu can send that email information out to anybody who wants to send me an email, or you can give me a call. My phone number is also on the screen there. So happy to take any questions, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Matt. Yes, I would be happy to share your contact information as well as the link for your website and the information that you shared earlier. So thank you. Chair Calabia, I do understand that we are behind schedule at this point, and we do have three hands up.
Before we get to the three hands, can you share with us the brochures that your slides are built on? If we give you our postal mailing address, can we get the brochures themselves?
You're asking if I can send you the slide presentation in paper format?
Yes.
You can go through Anu and she can reach out to me and do that. Yeah.
Okay. Anu, who are the three that are interested?
Okay. So just to be mindful of the time, it is 4:51. We have in the order Doris Ray, Denise Rush, Deborah Fisher, and then we have somebody joining through the phone call. I'm not sure if the person on the phone call is an AAC member. However, instead of 3 minutes, if we may just take a minute or so and quickly take the questions, that might be helpful. So Doris, go ahead, please.
Hi, would you like me to do the timing anew?
I'm sorry, Dr. Pazru?
Would you like me to do the 3 minute timer?
Sure, thank you.
Good.
Doris? Doris?
Doris, go ahead.
This is Doris Ray, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I am stunned by all the information. Thank you for providing that. Just to say that I am a member of the Access for All Committee at the of the Transportation Planning Board at COG. I'm wondering whether we are going to have a presentation about this as well. I also want to say that I was raised in downtown Silver Spring and lived there for some time with my mother finally living in Blair House, close to that second and Colesville. And I worked there for a number of years as well and commuted from Northern Virginia where I live. So I am concerned about the complexity of the features that you've described for the average pedestrian who has a vision impairment and may have some concerns about other people with other disabilities. But since I am blind and actually deafblind, I am very, very concerned at why there would even be a bus stop of that nature, a floating bus stop down at 2nd and Colesville. I can see why Charlie Crawford, who served on the AFA with me, was concerned about all of this. And I'm concerned about consistency throughout the region and the use of not just regulation detectable warnings, but the elongated strips that are used, as you mentioned, in other countries. I believe they came out of Japan originally, but anyway, it's not, we've spent a lot of time, the U.S. Access Board, in developing standards for truncated domes and detectable warnings and worked with the blindness community. And then even WMATA itself did a study pilot before they put in detectable warnings on the platform edge that
15
were not
seconds,
regulations.
Doris.
Not regulations. So I am concerned that Montgomery County and other jurisdictions continue to put in a numerous variety of detectable warnings and plans for floating bus stops without stopping and doing more testing and finding out before going on with a lot of different designs. So that's what I wanted to say. Thank you very much and would be glad to be involved in whatever work you do for the region on this, because it's a regional issue.
Yeah, thank you, Doris. I will tell you that I'm presenting to the Access for All Committee at your next meeting. So yes, you will be hearing me at the Access for All Committee. We agree with you in terms of the consistency. That's what we're trying to shoot for. We are definitely working to make all the Montgomery County stops consistent, but there's no national guidance. So if you're on vacation in Seattle, or if you want to take the bus in San Francisco, or you visit Chicago, there's no national guidance. And all those places have floating bus stops. We would love for there to be national consistency. In terms of the complexity, you kind of mentioned, well, we're using the longitudinal descriptors and things like that. We're using those because we got feedback from blind users, and we've done a lot of engagement. We certainly are going to do more engagement, but I didn't talk much about our
engagement. In Montgomery County, though, not people from D.C. and Maryland who are coming across to use them as well.
That's correct. People travel throughout the region, and that's why you want to work for regional consistency. But we did a lot of engagement. We brought blind people out into the field. We walked with them. We observed their behavior. We talked to them about their preferences. So we've learned a lot, and there's certainly a lot more work to be done. And we appreciate your offer of working with us as we go forward.
Next.
This is Denise Rush. The word mock-up was the best thing I heard. You've got to have the mock-up before you put up the anything, because that way you will get, and people will know what they didn't get or what to expect. But using the mock-up or having a place to try out the mock-ups is highly recommended. Thank you.
Next.
Hi, it's Debbie Fisher, and I am from Montgomery County. My question is, what kind of signage and warning are you giving to the cyclists? I'm a little bit concerned about the amount of responsibility and vigilance put on our blind and disabled pedestrians, and concerned that with no signage and warning to our cyclists, it isn't a shared responsibility.
Yeah, so what I would say to that, and I also realize I didn't answer part of Doris's question as to why we're doing this in the first place. But let me answer your question first by saying that I did show a picture of one of the floating bus stops, and we have the neon green signs that say state law, stop for pedestrians within crosswalk. So that's, you know, there is signage. There's also yield markings, and there's high visibility crosswalks. So I think, you know, using crosswalk markings, people who are drivers, and most cyclists are also drivers. They may not be driving that day, but most people who bike have driver's licenses. They know what a crosswalk is. Now, does that mean that they're going to stop 100% of the time? No, but drivers also don't stop 100% of the time at crosswalks. We have that signs. We're certainly looking to, if there's more that we can do to do that. We're planning to co-locate all of our future floating bus stops at signals. So you'll have a red signal. There will be cross traffic if there's a red signal. Pedestrians and vehicles. So cyclists are unlikely to just kind of blow through. And we've put in calming features like this, the lateral shift, the speed hump, things to help slow them down. And I can tell you that cyclists don't want to collide with pedestrians because if you're a cyclist and you collide with a pedestrian, you're likely to crash as well. So there's certainly, we want to do everything we can do to reduce the risk of collisions, but we are doing some things. And then in terms of why we're building floating bus stops in the first place, I would note that the issue with a bike lane and a bus stop in the traditional format is the bus has to enter the bike lane to get to the sidewalk. And this can be dangerous for cyclists. If the bus driver is not paying attention, the bicyclist can get pinched between the bike and the curb. It also means sometimes if the bus is going to be at the bus stop for a long time, the cyclist may have to enter the stream of traffic and go around. And so the idea behind floating bus stops is to actually manage the conflict and not increase the risk to pedestrians, but actually decrease the risk to pedestrians. Because right now in Montgomery County, you're permitted to ride a bike on the sidewalk. And so if we say, you know, you can ride a bike in the street, but you may get hit by a bus, or you may have to drive around a bus and ride your bike in the street, a lot of people are just going to bike on the sidewalk. So right now, if you're walking on the sidewalk, there could be a bike any square inch of that sidewalk, you could have a bike riding down it. By creating comfortable bike lanes, we're getting bicyclists off of our congested sidewalks and putting them in the roadway, essentially, but separated from cars, and providing a defined place where you can cross. So what that means is, yes, you have, as a pedestrian, you have to cross the bike lane to get to the bus stop, but you're doing it in a defined place where you know where that risk is happening, as opposed to right now or previous to these bike lanes, where you could be at a bus stop, standing on the sidewalk, and have a bicyclist speed past you with just inches spare because you're waiting on the sidewalk for the bus and there's no bike lane. So we understand the concerns, and we're going to continue to work with the disabled community to make sure that we're accommodating their needs. But there are probably over 100 floating bus stops, if not more than that, throughout the United States and Canada. They are growing in places. And what I think we could all benefit from is having some national guidance and some national standards so that we don't all have to kind of reinvent the wheel ourselves and come up with slightly different wheels in every county or every city. And I've seen floating bus stops throughout the region, throughout the country. In fact, I was just in Evanston, Illinois a couple of weeks ago outside Chicago and saw some floating bus stops, which don't have nearly as many of the features that I talked about in terms of like no signage, no detectable edge between the sidewalk and the bike lanes. You could wander into the bike lane inadvertently, things like that. There's no national guidance. What we would love for there to be is national guidance. And I hope that the guide that we have written and that I hope you'll all review will help lead to some of that national guidance so that we can have some standards to follow.
Thank you, Matt. I do see Jim Hamry has his hand up. Jim, would you please unmute yourself? And there we go.
Hello, Vanessa. I am the 3058. I had to use my because the features weren't working on the computer.
I see, Vanessa. Thank you. We'll have you after Jim. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Jim, we cannot hear you.
How does that sound? Better?
Yes.
All right. New technology, just learning how to use it. I just wanted to report out to the committee that since our last presentation last month, we did host a regional bus stop task force meeting, which included all representatives from all of the jurisdictions. And we were very pleased to have Matt give his presentation to that group. And that stimulated a lot of good conversation. I'm not sure that Matt was fully prepared to dedicate the rest of his career to floating bus stops, but sounds like he's taking on the national challenge, and we are happy to be working with him. As a result, the Regional Bus Stop Task Force is going to create a subcommittee to begin to review the great work in this report and how it applies to local projects. Within WMATA, we're creating a floating bus stop committee. I think we meet tomorrow morning, as a matter of fact, with our first session, so that we can review guidelines and requirements and figure out what we're going to do about the existing stops that are being proposed or deployed. And then we are initiating a scope of work to do a right-of-way safety and design study that will include creating floating bus stop guidelines and requirements that will get incorporated into WMATA design documents. And so hopefully we can work collaboratively with Matt and all the other project leaders around the region and at least get a consensus across the region where Metrobus is serving, if not among all operators. And then we'll take care of DC first and then move on to Maryland, Virginia, and the rest of the country.
Thank you, Jim.
Meeting tomorrow is of WMATA staff only, or WMATA staff and perhaps members of the disability community?
This is just a WMATA staff technical meeting. Anu and Carol are part of the work, the team. And so your views will be represented and we'll be happy to make progress reports as we hopefully make some progress.
Okay. There was another AAC member who wanted to speak.
Yes, I see Vanessa has her hand up and then Dr. Pazhar. Vanessa, go ahead.
Okay, well, my question kind of was asked with Doris. He's going to explain. I wanted to know the purpose for floating bus stops in Montgomery County, if he could give a brief, but it sounds like he is going to do that for Doris's question.
But the idea behind floating bus stops is that we try and manage the conflict between different users. I want you to imagine a world where there was no such thing as a sidewalk, where you were pedestrians and you just had to walk in the street and hope the cars didn't hit you, right? That's, which is, in some cases, that's kind of what the world is like. And imagine someone said, well, we're going to build this thing called a sidewalk, and the pedestrians are going to be out there. And then someone said, well, but what about, you know, now it's harder for me to find this or find that, or now I have to be in a different space. Well, the idea is we're trying to separate users. And that means separating bicyclists from drivers, because there's a conflict, and also separating bicycles from pedestrians. So we're trying to get bikes off the sidewalk, and we're trying to get bikes out of the roadway. But that means that there's a conflict inherent whenever we have a bike lane on the street that has a bus line, is that, well, the bus has to cross the bike lane to get to the sidewalk. So how do we resolve that conflict? And floating bus stops is one of the ways that conflict can get resolved. You know, in an ideal world, we would put bike lanes and bus lines on different streets. But in a place like downtown Silver Spring, if you look at every street in downtown Silver Spring, they all have bus lines. You know, if I want to put a bike, Georgia Avenue has bus lines. Spring Street, one block to the east, and actually Fenton Street, one block to the east, and Spring Street, two blocks to the east, they have bus lines. Second Avenue, one block to the west, has bus lines. East-West Highway, one more block to the west, has bus lines. So we have to manage that conflict, and that's the point. But it's not just about, you know, just making life good for bikes. It's also about improving the environment for pedestrians. I didn't talk about all the stuff that we do about pedestrians as part of our work, but, you know, narrowing the roadway, reducing the crossing distances at intersections, reducing the turning radius for cars, which makes those turns slower, improving the crossing time for pedestrians as part of our signal work, reducing the left turn conflict for both cyclists and pedestrians, for drivers turning left across the crosswalk. We're doing all those things as part of these projects. I'm specifically here to talk about floating bus stops, because if I was talking about everything that we're doing, I would take your whole meeting and then some, and I didn't want to do that. But the floating bus stops are really about trying to manage that conflict to define spaces. And absolutely, there are things that we can do to make them better, and that's what we're trying to do. And we would love to get your feedback. But that's kind of I think that's the shortest answer I can get. So I know we're way over time. So.
Well, oh, I'm sorry. What month of that advertisement are you guys using to tell the public?
I'm sorry, was the first part of your question?
What method of advertisement or training are you providing for the public?
Yeah, so we do talk with our commission on people with disabilities in Montgomery County. I attend almost every meeting, so I don't always speak, but I'm there observing and can make announcements if necessary. We also have an email list for individual projects, and I do promote those projects at the commission, so that if you're a blind person and you are a low vision person and you want to hear about more about projects, you can get on the email list. We do produce our graphics, our newsletters and things in screen reader format, so that people can still understand what's in the newsletter, even if they can't read the newsletter the traditional way. And so we're really trying to reach out to people directly. We talk to, you know, we do mail out notices for projects, like people who live within a couple blocks of a project, but just making sure that we try and reach out to the groups of people who have vision disabilities, those organizations that represent people who have disabilities, so that we can have them help us contact the people who are in their service area. If they say, you know, do you know someone who's blind who lives in this neighborhood that we can reach out to more directly, things like that.
Okay. Thank you.
It is 10 after 5, but we do have two more hands off. Dr. Posner and Patrick, if you would take a quick moment and state your question, and then we would move on to our next topic, which is Hannah, and she's been very patiently waiting for us.
Mr. Johnson, just a suggestion. If you want a national standard, you should contact Senator Duckworth's office. She is the head of the Disability Caucus in the Senate. Senator Van Hollen and Senator Cardin are also your senators, and they can directly access Secretary Buttigieg. And if you want something done nationally, that's the way to get it done. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Posner. Pat?
Thank you. I'll just be very brief. Matt, I appreciate all the work that you're doing, particularly bikes and peds, and also slowing down the cars and that sort of thing. I think my question goes to Carol Lopez and Jim concerning effective communication under ADA. My question is the use of accessible pedestrian signals as a way to indicate using oral description that there is a walk sign on to cross an intersection. Is that required under ADA as far as the use of effective communication rather than just a sign on a pole? So before going forward with your thoughts of designs, Jim, that is a question that we've had in Montgomery County.
So Patrick, there's a document called Public Rights of Way.
Mm-hmm.
And WMATA does use a lot of the requirements from the public's rights of way.
Right.
But
those are guidelines, all right. Yes.
Yeah, but it's not the law, and even there's not a specific requirement for audible signals at signalized cross. It's only required when you have a signal, a vehicular signal. But if you have a crosswalk someplace else, you're not required to have an audible signal.
Yeah, I will point out just real quick that since we're going to co-locate all of our floating bus stops in the future at signals, they will have the audible message, and we are planning to have, we haven't figured out exactly what the message is going to say, but we are planning to have some message that says something like, cross bike lane to get to bus stop.
Loading bus stop, right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And also, I did recently discover this, but every signal in Montgomery County has accessible pedestrian signals. They're not always the most up-to-date version. We're always upgrading them, but every signal in Montgomery County has accessible pedestrian signals. So
that's fantastic to know. I didn't realize that.
And that would be, that's been something that's been longstanding, and Charlie Crawford was a big proponent of that and worked hard on that. The location of the floating bus stops by intersections, Matt, would be very good. We still would have the conflict a little bit between mid-block floating bus stops like the one on Second Avenue. But you're saying that those...
15 seconds, Patrick.
Yes, thank you. But you're saying most of those would not be constructed in the future. You're looking at intersections.
That's correct. And we're also looking at if there's anything we can do for the ones that are like the one at Second and Colesville. It might not be possible to relocate that one, but the one that's at Second and Fenwick is a little bit closer to the signal. So we might be able to just move that one, right? So just going forward in the future, we're going to look at, can we rebuild these? Are there things that we can do to make them more accessible? And we're not going to say we built it and we're going to forget about it. We do want to make them, we've learned a lot and we want to make them more accessible. And I'll just close by saying thank you to all of you who've given us feedback. Pat helped us by actually meeting us in the field and walking with us and giving us feedback. We really appreciate that. So if any of you have comments or questions, feel free to email me or reach out otherwise. And I look forward to working with all of you in the future as we try and make Montgomery County and the region and all of the country more accessible for everyone.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. And I understand, I see Doris, you still have your hand up, but if anyone has any more questions, please email those to me and I would be happy to share your comments, questions, concerns with Matt and so that he can respond. And once there's more communication, I'll share those comments with you. Hannah Rowe, thank you very much. You have been very, very patiently waiting. We would go ahead with your agenda topic.
Hi, good evening, everybody. My name is Hannah Rowe. I'm the Senior Program Manager for the Platform Improvement Program. Newly come onto the project in the middle of the summer, but finalizing out phase 3 and phase 4. Just to give a brief update regarding the work that has been done to improve the stations from an ADA standpoint. Work will be similar on phase 3 as in phase 4. So in phase 3 here, we have rehabilitated the platforms with non-skid tiles. All lights have been upgraded with LED. Elevators have been refurbished with call buttons that are clearly separate from the help button. Bathrooms have been rehabilitated and brought up to ADA compliance. This includes adding and removing structural walls as was necessary. We've installed brand new PIDs with high visibility. And, I personally think they look really great. The emergency help buttons are now equipped with cameras, and the emergency button is different from the information button both in color and also in feel. All door hardware has been replaced with ADA compliant hardware. All new signage is compliant with ADA for directional purposes. All new door signage have raised Braille now for ADA assistance. Any manholes that we use for operational maintenance that are within the range of the boarding edge of the platform, within the 2 feet of the raised tactile stripping, have either been relocated or closed as we've done the structural changes on the platforms. The new areas of safe dispersal, which have to do with the in an emergency scenario, are that are currently newly built and constructed, are have been installed with ADA stalls as well as in the event of an emergency on the station platform. And you know, so all of these changes have been included in the phase three platform program, which covers six stations, four of them on the green line from and two of them on the blue line. Next summer, we will be on the orange line in Maryland from New Carrollton through Minnesota on five stations. Also of note would be that the construction phases of our platforms include all temporary accommodations and barricades installed per ADA guidelines with ADA shuttle buses if temporary measures cannot accommodate the conditions. I don't know if anybody has any questions, but that's the basic of the update of what's happening with the platform program.
Kelly Siminoff, a member of our Accessibility Advisory Committee, raised a question over the weekend regarding the inspections of stations, and I might be jumping the gun, Kelly, but...
yeah, I can chime in. It's okay.
Yeah, your question brought to my mind the Braddock Hump, the notorious Braddock Hump, the difference between the level of the platform and the level of an incoming train or a train that has stopped was really severe. I took a picture of it, but from my photo, I don't know if I can tell you how many inches the difference is, but in any case, it probably would be impossible for a wheelchair to manage the difference in height between the Braddock station platform at that point and a train that is waiting for passengers to board. How often are the platforms inspected to look at possible differences between the level of the platform and the level of a train that's waiting for passengers?
Hannah, would you mind if I answer that question?
I was about to ask if you would answer that question, Carol.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Tino, for that. First of all, I'd like to let you know that historically speaking, the reason that there's a 5/8 of an inch vertical gap requirement for the ADA for new stations, not the older stations, but the new stations, is because WMATA set an example and provided that, that the Noma Gallaudet station was the first station to have that. And then the access board said, we're gonna do this because WMATA can do it. So that's the first thing. We take very seriously the gap, the platform and gaps. We're always improving. Most recently, in the past few years, we changed the horizontal gap. We moved the rail closer to the platform, as close as you could without violating the, from the train so that the train won't hit the platform and as close as we could. And we have reduced our horizontal gaps down to, in some cases, 1.25 inches, whereas the ADA allows us 3 inches. Okay, so we're less than half in our newer stations, the ones that have been rehabilitated as well, we're moving them closer. The height is a little bit difficult to move down for the old stations to that small gap, horizontal gap, because you know, we already have elevators, we already have escalators at a certain height, and we can't have a sloped condition on our platform because then wheelchairs would roll out for people or baby carriages, etc. So we have so many restrictions. But however, each year when we go through the stations, we check, we do a visual check of all our gaps. And if we see any inconsistencies, we do spot checks. And if we have a condition that does not, I'm sorry, this running. And if we have a condition that's non-compliant, we alert engineering, and then they alert the track group, and then they go and fix the track, right? Braddock Road was an unusual situation because the platform buckled and the platform went higher, and then we couldn't fix it because there's some areas that were higher. It was an unfortunate condition. So that we fixed. It's all done, gone. We took care of it. So right now I am not aware of any real discrepancies, but the ADA allows us to have a gap. Either the platform can be a little bit higher or a little bit lower, and we're usually compliant. And if we're not, we take care of it.
And how often are the inspections made?
Well, our office checks it at least once a year. But I must tell you that there at least two people from our team are always on. That means me and somebody else from my team are always on the platforms. And whenever we see something, we're basically doing visual inspections. Then our track and structures group checks them at least twice a year with a dimensioning vehicle. Although the dimensioning vehicle, I found out, is not working right now, but we've been doing that all along. And each time our platforms are rehabilitated, we have the engineering team that goes and does a very thorough inspection of, you know, of alignment. So this past year, our office went and did a manual inspection for each door to at least 10 stations. I mean, each door opening for at least 10 stations.
As an example, the Braddock hump, how long did it take between discovering that it was a severe problem and having it corrected?
When we were alerted it was a severe problem, Mr. Blake and I actually went to the platform, we measured things, and we determined the areas of the platform that were accessible. And we had a plant went and put signage saying optimal boarding areas. We put announcements on the stations and saying that they're optimal boarding areas for people with disabilities who use wheelchairs. And then we also had announcements on the trains until we finally fixed it.
Finally. But how long did it take to correct the problem that was discovered?
I would say there was probably a number of years, but that entailed capital programming, funding, and planning for the station being out of service, which also is a challenge for many of our customers. So what we felt we should do, as Carol was talking about, the optimal boarding area project, which was presented to the AAC way before, you know, it was part of the planning process. And we felt that was a solution until we can actually get to construction. So the amount of time before the actual hump, as you describe it, was fixed, was not necessarily indicative of an effort to move things. It was indicative of us finding a solution in the short term and then finding the time and the opportunity to actually shut down the station and engage in the construction that was required. And we also did, in addition to the station and rail announcements, we also had daily reminders in our, if you were on the e-alerts and you subscribed to that particular station's messaging, every day there was a reminder about the optimal boarding area for that particular station.
Yes.
You know, Tino, I think the heart of your question here is regarding WMATA's seriousness and response time to issues that are raised. We, you know, while I wasn't on this former phase of the project, and, you know, to Christian's point, it does take us time to get major construction work and procured, contracted, you know, put the outage. It's quite an involved process, but I will tell you that the lessons that we've learned, particularly since the Braddock Hump, you know, Carol and Anu, they, we're very much on top of planning ahead to try and mitigate the issue while we are able to construct in the phases that have followed. So, I mean, Carol and I are in many meetings together to try and resolve issues while we still have the contracts available and open and while we're able to construct so that we can responsibly to the public, you know, do right by the ADA community as well as our public ridership. So, you know, while Braddock may have taken some time to resolve, we are very much on top of, you know, monitoring these gaps. I mean, my team, as we construct, you know, that's something that we monitor. Every time we have a test train come through, we actually have somebody out there measuring, you know, continuously with every train that comes through, how big that gap is so that, you know, because I think we all know an ounce of prevention is worth more than trying to correct it after it's gone wrong. So
can you give us the list of the kind of things that you inspect?
The kind of thing that my project team inspects. So I am not as familiar with the determination of the criticality. I think Carol can speak to that.
Okay. So the way that we control the measurements are top of rail. So the average of top of rail to top of platform, that dimension, and center of rail to side of platform, that's the other dimension. So that the vehicle is always going to be aligned with the platform in that way.
Kelly, I jumped the gun on your question, but did you want to chime in now that the question has been raised? Kelly?
Sure. Yeah, this is Kelly. Carol, I brought it up, and I'm sure Christian might have mentioned it to you, because as you know, a lot of like power wheelchairs also include like the, it's kind of like a screw that comes down off the bottom for so that they can engage it in an easy lock system so they can lock into a wheelchair accessible vehicle. And so if that height, train to platform height is such that it kind of goes beyond the scope of those minimum requirements, it can get lodged in between and like can really like make a power wheelchair get stuck in the door frame of a train. And so when a person I knew recently had that experience, and Anu didn't want me to get more information on the exact station it was at, so that is something I'm checking into, so y'all can go. I mean, I think it would probably require just going out and doing some measuring once we determine what station that was, but certainly, you know, it's an ongoing concern, and it would be good to know kind of what that, those checks are in place to make sure that we're getting visuals on tracks on a regular basis. I think that what you had to do up Braddock Road is a great solution as you find more permanent solutions, because he was even saying like, well, if I could only know like which train I needed to be in so I could know I could safely get on and off.
Okay.
You know, that's something that could be done. So I'll gather more information and we would love to hear how WMATA is continuing to respond to those concerns.
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing is, if you would please ask your friend that perhaps if they would tell us what the train number is. The train number is at on each car at both the front and the side. If they would tell us that, what we do is we could take that train out of service to make sure that that train was not defective or was not calibrated improperly. So that's another thing we do. We will go and check the station, and we also check the train if the station is actually still compliant with the other. So that would help us. So the train number is on the outside on both ends of the each car, and also on the inside in the back doors, in the doors that that are at the ends of the cars. That's where the train number is. And that would help us tremendously. We will go and check the station and make sure that we don't have a problem. Thank Great. You.
Actually,
Tina?
505, Jim Hamry was to come on with two items. Jim, are you still there? Jim?
Yes, I am. And happy to condense the presentations to fit in the available time.
Okay, good. Thank you, Hannah, by the way. Thank you. Jim, it's yours.
Not a problem. Thank you.
I would just point out that Metrobus supported Hannah's platform project this past summer by carrying 500,000 riders. We were able to essentially retain the ridership that was on the Green Line and to support it through the whole summer. So we're pleased with that. I guess the first item up is to talk about the December 2021 service adjustments for Metrobus.
Yes.
And as you know, in September, we launched a very resource-intensive and innovative approach to trying to generate new ridership, restore ridership, attract ridership through the introduction of the frequent service network, where we had 20 lines of service that essentially ran 12 minutes or better all day, every day, and another set of 16 lines that operated 20 minutes or better all day, every day across the region. Additionally, we added a number of individual trips to address crowding, to balance out service, and to, again, attract ridership. So we're very pleased that that is working the way it was supposed to. And so much of what we're doing for December is related to sustaining and supporting that initiative. The 12-minute network has added 27, almost 28,000 riders per day, 26% growth in the last 2 months. The 20-minute network is up 13%, adding 4,500 riders a day. And the added trips are up 9,900 riders per day, 43% increase on those lines that were served. All in all, Metrobus has added over 55,000 riders on a weekday over what we were doing in the summer. And we had peaked out last Wednesday at about 290,000 riders on Metrobus. So we're very pleased with that. But during this period, one of the significant impacts of COVID, the Delta variant, public health issues in general, has been an increase in the number of absences by our workforce while having a decrease in the total number of operators available. And so the challenge with December is to match the work to the workforce. And that means changing from 2,165 operator requirement of scheduled service to 2,090. As a result, we went and looked at the performance of all of the 34 weekday lines and all the weekday and weekend services, and came back with some minor modifications of service so that we could reduce the operator count. We made a specific initiative to schedule changing some of the parameters to result in having fewer operators rather than lower cost or fewer buses. And we have initiated a number of recruiting actions, including trying to attract a number of the drivers who are currently employed by Transdev as a contractor operating out of the Cinderbed division. The Cinderbed division, by agreement with the local 689 union, is being brought in-house. So it'll be directly operated by Metrobus staff, and the bus is maintained by Metrobus staff rather than the contract operation, which has been in place for the last 3 years. So we went about writing a schedule based on aligning the service with the workforce, making sure that we were meeting our requirements for customer service and trying to address crowding issues where they were identified, making sure that there were alternative services where any reduction was made, either directly by Metrobus, by Metrorail, or through a local operator, making sure that we were supportive of the equity initiatives that the board had identified, and making sure that we maintain the integrity of the big service initiative, the frequent service network that was begun in September, and then respond to local initiatives and requests, specifically the Alexandria Vision Plan, where we had a coordinated service plan along with Dash that changed the network of services within the city. The amount of Metrobus remained the same, but it was being used in different ways to complement initiatives by the city. Our December services changes will take effect on December 26th. And if I can successfully share my screen, I have a summary of what we're changing.
I can see your screen, Jim.
Is that working?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
So one of the things we looked at was the amount of ridership that was actually happening on the services and determined to reduce the frequency on several lines to better align the resource to the actual ridership. And so the 11C, which is a line in Fairfax County that operates into Alexandria, going to a 30-minute frequency. The 29G, which is a service in the Annandale area of Fairfax County, reducing the frequency to 24 minutes. Previously, it had been 20. In the District of Columbia, the Mount Pleasant line, the 4243, we've widened the headways a little bit. They were already extremely attractive at 6 minutes, back to 9. On the North Capitol Street line in the district, we went back to the a little bit wider than the 8 to 10 that we had been operating in peak. The C2C4, which is the line that runs basically from Prince George's Plaza all the way across to Twin Brook in Montgomery, that we had some short trips between Prince George's Plaza and Wheaton that we've removed. They're not needed for the capacity And then the Massachusetts Avenue line in Northwest DC, we've sort of balanced out the schedule corrected one trip on Rex, which is the Richmond Highway Express, to reflect the actual demand in the direction of flow for the morning rush period. On the 1B, which is a line in Fairfax County that operates from Dunloring Station toward Vienna, we had some supplemental trips, and instead of having them across 3 hours of time, we have them across an hour and a half of time, which is the peak of the peak. We had contemplated temporarily suspending the Lee Highway DC line operating from Arlington into the district. But in light of the changes, the challenges to the rail service that occurred a few weeks ago, we decided to retain that. It's one of the lines of service that crossed the river between Virginia and the district. We also, in the area around the Northern Virginia Community College campus of Alexandria, Fairfax, just a little west of Arlington, we made some adjustments in the frequency of service there. And on New Hampshire Avenue, we have been operating the Metro Extra K9 from Fort Totten on out toward White Oak. What we identified is that there were only four riders on the bus stop that's not shared with all of the stops on the K6, which is the all-day, everyday service. So we're going to suspend the K9 and let all the riders continue to use the K6, which again is one of our 12-minute all-day, everyday services. So we think that be of minimal impact to the public. And as I mentioned, Cinderbed will be transitioning to be a direct operation facility. So from December 26th to January 2nd, the services that will be coming out of Cinderbed will actually be operated out of Shepherd Parkway Division. And that will allow for the current contractor to clean their offices and move out of Cinderbed Division, and all of the bus transportation and maintenance folks to then move their tools and supplies in and be ready to operate from that facility going on into the future, effective January 2nd. There's a lot of coordination that will be taking place, but at this point, we think we will be able to continue to operate all services throughout the holiday season. There may be some interruptions that could occur as a result of operator shortages or vacations or other issues. Our ridership during the holiday week is usually about 2/3 to 3/4 of normal. In this instance, we think we just want to maintain normal and continue to keep the riders we have. I'll stop there and answer any questions.
You are also going to speak about e-paper signage. If there are no questions on what you just related to us, maybe we could move on to e-paper signage.
All right. So the e-paper, do you have a question?
No, Jim, just one comment. This is, I'm sorry for the interruption. I know Thomas Mangrum has his hand up, but I believe he had put his hand up when Hannah was giving her presentation. Mr. Mangrum, if you would please send me your question, and I would be happy to share it with Hannah. Thank you. Go ahead, Jim.
All right. Well, I believe Jonathan Guder is still monitoring the meeting. He's the project manager for the customer electronic information display system, which we lovingly called SEEDS. Only Metro could come up with an acronym like that. And it represents all of the digital information platforms that we are putting out at the bus stops. We actually have 6 different types of displays that we've been using over the past few years. There's the standard LED, that's the 2-line dot matrix electronic sign that you see at bus stops, bus stop shelters. We've been deploying a relatively new product called e-paper, which is like a Kindle, larger size than that, allows for more flexibility in terms of the design of the display and how you format the information and the ability to update it in real time. We have a product called a digital bus stop sign, which is cheaper than the e-paper display, battery powered, primarily used for some initiatives that we had in Virginia before the pandemic. We had a LCD, liquid crystal display signage program that was inherited with the Silver Spring Transit Center. Those were basically large TV screens that had all the information. They life cycled out, and we have since replaced them with the standard LED display that we have at all the other Metro bus terminals. And then Arlington Alexandria had a product that they used on the Metroway and at Silver Spring, Crystal City, and Roslyn. And then Arlington also has some 55-inch display units that they use at the transit stores. All of those are fed by the information that comes off of the buses, is translated through our bus ETA software, and then is displayed via our SEEDS messaging management system. One of the initiatives we have this year is deploying the e-paper, which is a product that we are purchasing from a company called Luminator. That's the company that provides the destination signs on the buses. And so far this year, we've deployed 62 signs at various bus stops across the region. 23 of them are on right-of-way within the district. 26 are in Prince George's County. 6 are in Montgomery County. 3 in Alexandria, 1 in Arlington, and 3 in Fairfax. Over the course of the rest of this fiscal year, we anticipate being able to implement an additional 100 of these signs, working collaboratively with the jurisdictions to identify the key locations and the priority installations for these displays. Many of you have seen the display. It's a little bit larger than a tablet, not quite as big as a full personal computer, but we find that they are able to go on the poles that we have. They are solar powered, so they don't have to be hooked up to the grid electrical system. We've been working closely with DDOT to come up with a design for tying into the solar energy panels that they're planning to deploy on their own shelters. And additionally, there is a pilot demonstration that will be taking place later this year at Braddock Road Metro of a different product that has a little larger display that will be able to tie into our own solar program as the shelters get replaced. The basic orientation is that if there is 100 or more boardings per day at a bus stop, then that qualifies for the investment of having grid electricity and an LED sign. If there are more than 50 people at a bus stop, then that warrants the investment of the e-paper sign. The digital bus signs are cheap enough that we could do that for 25 passengers or more. All of these are intended to complement the static information that's at the stop, the flag, the pole, the raised letter plaque, the bus stop information panel, and all of them also have the audio display, except for the digital bus stop, the battery powered displays that we have in Virginia. All of them do have the audio push button feature, and I think they even offer Spanish translation as part of the narrative. In the future of this program, there are 1,205 bus stops in the system that pre-COVID would have warranted an LED display. There are over 1,700 bus stops with pre-COVID numbers that would warrant a e-paper sign. We are, of course, not pre-COVID anymore, we're post-COVID. And so we're in the process of reviewing with the jurisdictions our bus stop amenities and investments. And as part of that study I mentioned earlier, where we're looking at updating the bus stop guidelines to include the floating stops, we will also be incorporating a public policy about the deployment of the digital information and ultimately making sure that bus planning has the resources and all the contract mechanisms to keep them functioning. It's a complicated world with integration of communications and software and display units and solar power and batteries. And so, okay, we've just recently done an update of our software and are working out some of the bugs. The expectation is it will provide more reliability, and it will also incorporate the Google Transit field with the real-time information. So we'll be able to provide more information in the displays, like how many people are on the bus and whether there are detours in effect and that sort of thing. There are a number of projects going on around the authority right now, and in a year or two, we'll probably have a whole generational update to talk about the technology, and the displays are evolving quickly, and we're doing our best to stay with them. Happy to answer any questions about that.
Jim, you mentioned that there's an audio capability. When you press the button, whether it's in Spanish or in English, what kind of information is spoken to you when you press the button?
It's a direct translation of the information that is presented on the sign. So for example, it would read the Georgia Avenue line, Route 70. Buses are anticipated to arrive 12 minutes, 24 minutes, and 36 minutes from now.
Okay. Members, Anu, does anyone have a hand up?
Chair Calabria, Doris has her hand up. So Doris, go ahead, unmute yourself and ask a question.
Hi, this is Doris Ray, and number one, I wanted to say in relation to the floating bus stop presentation that the gentleman from Montgomery County mentioned changing the bus stop design, and I want to say that I recall, Mr. Hamry, that you had come to us and talk to us when Northern Virginia, particularly Arlington, was having changes to the bus stop plaques. And we noted that having the standard white pole was best visible for people with vision impairments. So I hope you can talk them into that, particularly at night when you're trying to find a bus stop. So that was something that you had already talked in favor of, and I hope you'll talk them out of a blue bus stop pole. the
I'd be happy to do that, Doris.
The second thing that I want to ask, though, is, you know, we had the program of placing the signage, the plaques, with the bus stop numbers, so that people could use the number to call in and get real time information. And I don't have necessarily any concern with that, except how high they're hung, so that if you're not at a, you know, bus stop that you might regularly use every day, you're not going to have that number memorized. And and I know there's an alternative, but since the customer information line is not operating with the frequency it used to, I'm wondering if there's any program to move those plaques down, and so that they're readable by people who are blind and vision impaired when they're moving throughout the
30
system.
Seconds, Doris.
Yeah, that's one and of the tasks.
And then also the audible signs that we're using, of whatever electronic signs of whatever kind. I'd like to know where they are and you know how I'm going to see them and know to use them, because actually they're very hard to find on most bus shelters that are in the, you know, on the line, out on the line.
Well, thank you for those questions. On the point about the height and placement of the raised letter plaques, that's mm-hmm. one of the challenges I'm giving the regional bus stop task force, because we've gotten away from having standard height for the information, and we tend to put the information panels from the ground all the way up as high as they can get in order to save on installation. And one of the things we need to do is be standard about that. If you run out of space on
right
the pole, move
to
another pole, that sort of thing. And
they're right next to the plaque, the flag, and right. That doesn't do anybody any
and
good.
And the audio button is for all the projects that we're initiating are on a standard location on the shelter at the what we call the downstream end of it. Hopefully that will become standard. Now the e-paper displays have a different placement of the button. Carol has been challenging us to do better as we've been working with DDOT on the installation on their shelters. And so I don't have a final answer for that, but we will definitely continue to find a standard that works in all different types of shelters in all of the various jurisdictions that we'll be deploying these signs. And I did fail to mention that with the message management system, our system is designed to incorporate all of the bus operators. All seven of the locals are currently engaged with us. The two of the three commuter buses provide us real-time feeds and are displayed on the system. So it's not only designed to work for us, but also to support the locals.
Unfortunately, it's 6 o'clock, and by contract with the interpreters, we have to shut down. I had mentioned to Kelly by email that she would have an opportunity to talk about emergency situations on the rail cars. Kelly, I promise you, we'll start with that question because emergencies are coming up, unfortunately, more rapidly than we would want to count on. In any event, because we are now over time, this meeting is now adjourned. Thank you all.